You lie there, basking in the warmth, your surface rubbed smooth by the restless seas, the relentless wearing grind of sand and water. But at last you are where you longed to be, high on the beach, enjoying your place in the sun, safe. At the first pangs of creation, you were hurled by the hand of God into the infinities of space. For millions of years, you lay in the dark, beneath the waves. But very gradually, millimetre by millimetre, you were hauled by tides and eddies along the ocean floor until at last you're thrown by the waves onto the beach. Days pass and years, and bit by bit you edge your way up the shingle, fraction by fraction, millimetre by millimetre, inch by inch, to your place in the sun. It's warm, perfect. You have arrived. Then along come a cheerful dad and his son, and the dad says, "I bet you, son, I can skiff that stone 7 times. The bet is on. The stone is picked up and hurled back 40 million years. It sinks ignominiously to the bottom of the sea. Time to start all over again. Oh dear, rats." If stones could talk, is that what they would say? "Not me, throw that one over there." Do you know how many millennia, how many light years it took to get here? Would they plead for mercies if stones could talk? And what tales would the stones tell of the aeons and centuries and millennia they'd witnessed, the cataclysmic upheavals, the new themes woven into the social fabric, the brutal, crazy march of history? The stones have seen it all, watched silent as the world turned again and again. Once proud temples to indestructible deities, now a pile of rubble over which the tourists clamber. If the stones could speak, what tales they would tell. And none more eloquent than the stones of Israel, carved into desert fortresses and soaring temples, tramped across by countless armies, witness to the drama that was God's chosen people. The Bible is full of stones, special stones, big stones used as pillows by terrified Old Testament tribesmen surrounded by the sullen wilderness, yet meeting God where the fear was most crippling. Small stones slung and flung by shepherd boys in no contest shootouts with giants. Stones made into sacred altars for holy sacrifices and for foul idolatries. Plenty of stones. Hunger ached in him. I promise you, you have never been hungry like this. His eyes swam with the heat, the dust, the gnawing fierceness of the hunger. "Turn the stones into bread," the seductive voice whispered. "Who would know? You're all alone out here. Much more of this and you'll be dead. So turn the stones into bread. What's the point of having power if you won't use it? You can do it. Or maybe you can't. Stones into bread. Stones into bread." An insistent drumbeat in the brain. "It is written, you shall not tempt the Lord your God." Temptation, tugging and relentless temptation, just where it hurt most. Overcome in the power of God and the sheer commitment to his destiny. And the story can continue to its proper conclusion. Later, they hated his presumption, the carpenter's son with the dubious pedigree, telling them about God's purposes as if he had some kind of direct line to God. They were offended by his air of authority. Come on, he was just a local boy who'd gotten above his station. And now all this dangerous talk about being fulfillment of the Old Testament. As if religious sensibilities were bruised. He could give this town a bad name. He could bring trouble here. He would need to be got rid of him. Take him and stone him. The lynch mob mentality. He's either mad, bad, or dangerous, or all three. Best dispose of the problem before it becomes too big to be disposed of. So they manoeuvre him towards the killing zone, discreetly located at the edge of town. Hurl him over the incline and stone him to death. That would sort out the problem, once and for all. Then, to their annoyance, he slipped mysteriously through the angry crowd and away to safety, and the moment was gone. Most unfortunate, most inconvenient. No good will come of it, you can be sure. She deserved to die, so the rule book said. So the self-righteous, self-appointed kangaroo court said, the adulteress, the harlot. They stood around, their faces hard with self-righteousness and judgment. She deserved to die. He wrote in the sand, scrawled with his finger in the dust. The woman trembled. Her life would depend on the answer he would give. Stone her, he said. They smiled in triumph. Got you now, whore. But, he added, let the one among you who is without sin cast the first stone. After a long silence, one by one they dropped the rocks and shuffled off, burning with shame, seeing themselves for the first time in a long time. The woman raised her eyes. Does no one condemn you? Nor do I. Go and sin no more. Simon, you have such strength and such vulnerability at once. On the faith of men like you, on the courage of men like you, my church will depend, Simon. Sometimes it's as if you haven't understood a thing I'm saying, understood what this is all about. It isn't about sitting on a throne, lording it over other people. It is about serving and about dying to self. There is a cross in all of this. No, shh, listen to me. There is a cross in all of this, for me, for you. Simon, I've prayed for you, that you will be a rock for the others, for the future, in face of what will come. No longer will you be called Simon, but Peter the Rock. And from a whole collection of living stones, with faith like yours, the church will be built and will go on being built. Stones like you, shaped by my Spirit into men and women of faith, courage, faithfulness and love. And Christ, the cornerstone, the stone the builders rejected, the cornerstone of that wonderful, perplexing, frustrating, glorious church. He rides into town and the crowd cheers him on. Why not? It's festival time. Time to do daft things like riding on a donkey, like some Old Testament hero, coming in peace and with laughter into the ancient city, through the ancient gate, past the city walls, their large blocks of stone, huge with history. And it's as if the stones of that poor haunted city do indeed shout out. Tell the people, pay attention here. Listen to your history, realise what this is all about and the significant times in which you live. We talk of people, places being steeped in history, and nowhere more so than Jerusalem, where the prophets were misunderstood and reviled, the kings ruled, and the soul of the nation was won or lost on countless occasions. Into that cauldron of time and trouble, that crucible of Israel's hopes and dreams, and that place of so many disappointments and failures, crimes and catastrophes, one more pale rider comes, the donkey's hooves clip, clip, clopping on the cobbles, and the shouts and cheers of the children celebrating, anticipating, setting the agenda for the week ahead. Enthusiastic and unable to contain their joy, is it all going to be different now? Is the kingdom come? Has our king come at last? Well, the ancient stones of the old city, they had seen it all and heard it all. Seen them come and seen them go. We don't need another hero. Could they ever have imagined that 2,000 years later, awestruck pilgrims, followers of the donkey-riding king, would wander and wander among the ancient stones, feel history and miracle throb through the soles of their feet, as the tour guide explains. This is where the procession came, down this hillside, through this gateway. and here was where the final act of the drama took place. Or that this coming Palm Sunday, thousands of miles away, in a world of space shuttles and supersonic planes, of worldwide webs and laptop computers, we would remember that hilarious journey and sing about it. Rejoice that he set his face to go to Jerusalem for the final conflict with sin and hate. Would the ancient stones of that ancient city have thought for one second that we sophisticates of 21st century Europe would choose to unite our hosannas with theirs? And in our way, in our time, with our faith, raise a welcome for the King who comes to Zion, peaceful and lowly, riding on a donkey.